Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Monday's episode of the Terrace Scottish Football Podcast. I am Craig Fowler, and on today's show I am joined by Mr. Tom Watt.
Hello. That's a big highfalutin intro. I feel like I should be rushing down with my Titantron music blaring.
And Joel Skid. Joel, what would your Titantron music be?
No idea. I didn't understand any of that sentence after, what would your... And then that was it.
What would your entrance music be if you were a wrestler?
Oh.
I think you've answered this before, if you're not.
I think it was for darts. And it would just be something ridiculous like, Sinead O'Connor, nothing compares to you.
That was it. You did pick that before. We asked everybody to pick the wrestling theme song for one of the playlists we've done, and you picked that.
Oh, yeah, that. So it was.
Oh, I'd love to see a wrestler adopt that, or a darts player. It'd just be...
It would throw off.
You visually see the atmosphere leave the stadium.
yes you would. Right, we're together to talk through the four games from the weekend that involved top flight clubs. So those were the Betfred Cup semi-finals and the two Scottish Premiership games as well. We'll put the Premiership games to one side for the moment and start with the big matches from the weekend. Those were, of course, the Betfred Cup games at Hampden, one on Saturday evening, the other one on Sunday afternoon / evening, and Not the best of games, but still plenty of talking points. And we should begin with the game on Saturday. And Hibs. Good old reliable Hibs. You can't rely on them to do anything except for make a fucking arse of it. And that's certainly what happened on Saturday. Joel, I'll go to yourself first, because I know you'll be chomping at the bit. What did you make of the game?
It was different for me because, like, when Hibs do Hibs things like that, it's always more fun to watch it. By all accounts, they were the better team for a large chunk of the first half, certainly the first half hour or so, until St Johnston went ahead. Unfortunately, I was working at the Hearts game that day, so I was unable to watch it live. So it was a case of watching it back on the Sunday when you kind of know what's already happened. So it loses a bit of that luster, a bit of that amusement, because you can see it. So it was still enjoyable none the same. But it's bigger picture. It seemed like Hibs had gotten over their ability to Hibs it, but it's come roaring back these last few months.
Yeah, there's a lot of criticism of Jack Ross after the game that he is basically kind of, well, in the league overall, although they've not played that well recently, he's tended to make them a bit more resolute, a bit less kind of looking like bottle merchants. But he's certainly getting the kind of... He's certainly been accused by the Hibs fans of kind of returning this Hibs in it tag, because that's them now kind of managed to completely arse it up again in a big game. And it's... So it's obviously there's this game. There's the Scottish Cup semi-final defeat to Hearts earlier in the season. But there's also kind of maybe some other games, if you look at in the league, like losing both home and away to Aberdeen, failing to defeat Celtic when two goals up and Celtic were at their nadir, really. Well, Celtic have had a few nadirs this season, but that was one of them. And also as well, you know, needing a last-minute equaliser to get a draw against Celtic at Celtic Park when...
You can go back to last season as well, because of the last derby of the season, Easter Road. I mean, Hibs could have essentially put another nail in Hart's coffin towards the championship. Obviously, we didn't know what was about to happen was going to happen, and it was an absolute abysmal performance to get beat 3-1.
So, Tom, what do you think of the general criticism of Jack Ross? You've obviously seen Tony's... Well, I'd assume you'd seen Tony's thread about it on Twitter and things that he posted in the group chat himself. What do you make of it all?
I mean, I'll start by giving the one thing I can say that in his defence is Hibs did start well, and you can't really mitigate for Jamie Murphy's miss. And the first 20 minutes when they were creating a lot of like 4v4s and opportunities out wide. But every big decision that was made tactically kind of came back to haunt them. I mean, a lot, obviously this is with hindsight, but you know, Jackson Irvine was very involved but then tired. Chris Cadden unsurprisingly looked knackered after 50 minutes. Boyle couldn't get involved. Nisbet was isolated. And because of what Callum Davidson did tactically, was pretty smart, Jamie Murphy was essentially being asked to play, was doing a lot more tracking back than he was comfortable with. And these things are kind of fine margins, but I do think there is now there's enough of a repetitive pattern with Jack Ross for this to now be a thing where he's almost overthinking his selections. He's got a big squad. He's got a number of ways of playing it. And obviously the way that he wants to have a squad is a squad that's able to play in fairly comfortably in four or five different setups. The problem with that is if that's the plan, you need to be able to change games. You need to be able to impose your style on teams when things go against you. So, you know, they had the momentum. They lost the momentum through the goal, but they couldn't get back into it. And ultimately, the sort of tactical changes that Ross tried to do made Hibs even worse. So I think they've almost... He's had a habit occasionally of finding problems where there aren't them. And I mean, reading some of the comments about Sunderland from Sunderland fans back in the sort of 2018-19 season, being very reactive to the team that they're playing rather than, we've got a better squad, we've got better players, this is the team that I feel is the best 11 that I've got that can go out and impose themselves on a smaller squad and on a, you know, St Johnstone have been good this season largely, but don't tend to score an awful lot of goals, certainly don't tend to score 3 goals. And if the squad was built for this flexibility, then he's got to, you know, the buck stops with him. He's got to be able to make game-changing decisions and game-changing tactical switches. And I think ultimately all of the big decisions that he made around the selection, around the setup, you know, came back to bite him. There are mitigating circumstances, I think, obviously in the miss and some inexplicable defending from Ryan Porteous. But again, if you're going to pick Ryan Porteous he does have that in him. So I think most of the criticism, if not all of it, is entirely justified. And it's very easy to sort of try and find a narrative in this, but I do think part of it may be that if you've come through and learned your coaching and kind of earned your managerial spurs at St Mirren and Alloa, part of what will make you punch above your weight is looking at your next opponent and looking at how they set up and trying to figure out what you can do to mitigate risk. You then go to a team like a Sunderland or a Hibs, where in, you know, 10 out of 12 games, 7 out of 12 games probably, you should be able to just set up with your best 11 and minor tweaks are needed rather than, you know, ripping it all up and starting again and throwing on some untested players and being your own worst enemy, which I think was ultimately the problem that Hibs had.
Joe, what did you make of the starting 11? Because you can look at it another way and say that they were kind of... Because for me, I thought that Ross's biggest failing in this game wasn't necessarily the decisions to start with. It was the decision to change the team after going 2-0 down, because that was undoubtedly the wrong thing to do, because the shape had generally been working not too bad. They'd lost two goals for set pieces, which is obviously a failing on you know, not only the defenders but the coaching staff as well. If your team is struggling to defend set pieces, then you kind of have to look at yourself and look at what's been done in the training ground. But at the same time, I think they were still, in terms of overall play, the better side at that point in time. And instead of kind of panicking and throwing on another striker, it's kind of like, it's one of these kind of tired, you know, lazy kind of lines of thinking in football where you think, right, okay, we need to score goals, so the best thing to score goals is to fling on another forward. Whereas I think if they just put Doidge on, because I've been playing with two up front anyway, put Doidge on, keep the same shape of the team, and then just try and increase the pressure on St Johnstone as the game went on. But the change to the system just completely killed any hope they had of getting back into the game, because for that point forward, St Johnstone were the better side.
Yeah, so two aspects of that. The change to what was 4-4-2 with Jamie Murphy as... Jamie Murphy can play wide, but he has to play wide in a 4-3-3, not a 4-4-2, because he just doesn't have it in him to kind of track back. He's like the Stevie Mallon of wingers when it comes to the defensive responsibility. With this starting 11, I think, listen to Ross's comments after the game, and he mentioned about like the team's reaction to going behind, the character and the guts. I always question when managers go down that route, because you look, I think it was it Kenny McIntyre asked him if Ross would do anything different with like the starting 11 or tactics, and I think at that point in the interview Ross was already fed up with Kenny McIntyre, but he basically said no. And as Tom has said and yourself has said, he did make mistakes. For me, obviously it's easy with the benefit of hindsight, Cadden wasn't, and as expected, isn't going to be fully fit. For me, when you play at Hampden Park, and I think you want to get Martin Boyle wide. I know Hibs fans, I know, I think you made the point as well, Fowler, that you want Martin Boyle to be higher, but I think it worked well, just going back a couple of years ago, where Hibs kind of played a lopsided 3-5-2, where you had Stevenson was a bit more defensive, and then Boyle was given a bit more freedom to get up and down the line. I think you need to, obviously, Nisbet playing with Doidge is a smart thing. So with hindsight, I would have played Boyle wide on the right and had Nisbet alongside Doidge. I thought Jackson Irvin, again, he was another one you kind of questioned fitness-wise to play such a big game, a big pitch, but I thought he was absolutely brilliant. So it was kind of just tweaks to the starting 11. But yeah, the main one of these main tactical errors was going 4-4-2 against St Johnstone and just giving up the centre of the pitch, essentially.
Tom, is it a bit premature to say that Jack Ross is under pressure?
No, I think he is under pressure. I think it would be unfair for him to be under, you know, for there to be serious questions about his job whilst there's, you know, still a fair bit to play for. But you don't need, especially this season where there are a lot of not very good teams, you don't need to have too many bad games in a row for pressure to start to build. And Hibs have now blown two big opportunities this season when they were heavy favourites. And in both games, his decision-making has come into question. It's not necessarily been, you know, they've not been in the fight. the way that they haven't been able to impose their way on games. I think we do have to give a lot of credit to Callum Davidson. I thought they were. There's a very good piece by St. Johnstone Fan Analysis on the changes that he made, in particular switching Conway and Witherspoon, and how that exploited Jamie Murphy at having to track Sean Rooney, which ultimately was where a lot of the damage to Hibs was done. So I think an awful lot of credit does have to go to Davidson, but I think it's not unexpected for teams that have bad runs, and I think Hibs have had one win in the last seven now, and two fairly meek cup exits so far this calendar season, or this, whatever we're calling it. Then I don't think it's unfair for him to be under pressure and for there to be questions asked.
And yeah, let's move on to St. Johnstone now, because they were the victors in the game, so we should definitely talk about them before we move on. And so you brought up the man, look at the man of the hour, Sean Rooney. I said before the game that it's a major blow for St. Johnstone that Danny McNamara went down to Millwall and they were given a replacement, but obviously the replacement either isn't quite on the same level or isn't fit enough to start a game of this magnitude, and I think his name's James Brown. And I thought, right, that's it. Sean Rooney instead. That's going to be it's going to be a major weakness for St. Johnstone, because this McNamara was one of their kind of shining lights in the first half of the season, and to lose him and to have like a, I know that Rooney's a right back by trade, but he looks like a centre half. So you're kind of like, you're almost thinking like this is an auxiliary centre half playing at right wing back here. But you saw on Saturday that he's got a terrific engine. He does, for somebody his size, deceptively quick. He get up and down the park, and he had just a storming game.
This is, yeah, Rooney was one who stood out for me against St Mirren last week when he played wing back. He just looks like a racehorse up and down the right flank. He kind of like he's got a similar build and movement to Jason Naismith, where they look like centre backs, but can shift, and when they get moving, it's hard to stop them because he is so physically imposing. I think it was Eric Nicholson read him pre-match, and he was kind of looking at the preview, and he said that Sean Rooney is basically the four centre-backs. So if one of Gordon, McCarter, Kerr out, he'll fill in as he did against Dundee United in the 2-2 draw, and he's capable of playing that. But he is a very different type of player to McNamara, but I think he can be as devastating. I think McNamara's probably a better crosser. McNamara's more of a winger than Rooney's defender, but in terms of Rooney, when he gets going, I think he can power into the box, and then it's just a question of getting his head up and picking someone out.
So another St. Johnstone player I'd probably look at, especially since Saints fans have really not been that big in him for a lot of the season. He's had his moments, but overall I think they've been a little bit underwhelmed with his signing, but he certainly played well on Saturday, and he's been mentioned already, and that's Craig Conway. Somebody who I think at times on Saturday looked a bit more like the Craig Conway of old, like kind of turning back the clock a little bit, dude, kind of sprinting runs down the wing, looking to take on defenders, acting like a proper winger. Whereas a lot of this season, he's kind of been relied on a bit more for his crossing, and obviously considering he's 34, 35, then he doesn't quite have the pace as he used to do at Dundee United and just kind of skin fullbacks for fun. He'll more likely now kind of stop. And then kind of look to shift the ball and maybe even put in like an in-swinging cross rather than getting to the byline, putting an out-swinging one. But he was certainly instrumental in getting St. Johnstone in front and then scoring the third goal as well, which just capped everything off. And you knew for that point, I mean, you say this most games, 3-0, that'll be it. But I think everybody knew for certain there was going to be absolutely no danger of some sort of historic comeback happening at Hampden once he put the ball in the back of the net.
I think tactically he was a really important switch as well. Like the way that if you had Witherspoon, who sort of drifts inside, can kind of go inside and out, and you've got Conway who was basically trying to, if not hit the byline, was certainly more of a traditional winger. It was a very different proposition, and I don't think Hibs ever quite got to got to grips with that when that was moved around.
With the 4-3, with the 3-4-3 St Johnstone play, so it started off with Conway on the right and Conway on the right and Boone on the left. So naturally, Conway is just going to go on the outside. So he's going to play as a winger. But when you're playing that formation with Chris Kane up front, you need your two wider players in the three to play a bit more central, to give a bit more support. And you've seen that with the build-up to the first goal. So obviously, Conway started on right. He moved across to the left. And you've seen with the first goal and the build-up, he actually comes really narrow and allows Scott Tanzer to overlap him. And then he drives from a central position and ends up winning the corner, which leads to the first goal scored by Kerr.
Before we move on to this game, I just want to say I've got one more point, one more kind of analytical point, which was the header for the first goal. So I just wanted to bring this up because we often see it the other way, where it's talked about where you say, like, the ball goes in at either of the posts and people say, well, why didn't they have a man on the line? I thought that was a perfect example of why a lot of the times it's pointless to have a man on the line. And the statistics show that you're more likely to defend a corner successfully if you don't have men on the line and instead use them in the penalty box to restrict space. And I thought that was a perfect example. I think it was Jamie Murphy who was on the post. And the header goes in pretty much where Murphy's standing, about half a yard to his left. But it's headed from about 5 or 6 yards. It's got so much power in it that unless it was right at Murphy, he really has no chance of doing it. And he doesn't react typically that slowly. He moves his body, but he knows he can't handle the ball. So he kind of has to move his arm behind him as he's moving across, which obviously kind of hinders his movement as well. And I just thought, so many times in football, when it's the other way around, people bemoan the lack of a man on the post. But I thought that was the best example. If Murphy was standing 5 yards forward, or 6 yards forward, or whatever, and could help hinder Rooney's run. Jason Kerr's run.
Kerr scored the first.
Yeah, if he could stop Kerr's run, then that would have been a lot more beneficial than him standing on the post and just seeing a powerful effort fly past him.
Yeah, absolutely, because the biggest issue of that goal was Porteous and his positioning, because if you look at the two, I think it's Hanlon and most likely be like Irvine or McGinn, so they're man marking and they're touch tight to their opponent, so they're not getting a good run. Porteous body position at all points was wrong, and he never got touch tight to Kerr. So by the time he turned and he'd lost Kerr, he misjudged the flight of the ball, and then he wasn't able to put kind of just a little bit of physical pressure on Kerr to put him off. It was it wasn't his finest moment.
Right, let's move on to the second set. The final thing I was going to say, just for a wee bit of patter. It was almost better, Hearts losing to Raith Rovers earlier in the day, because I had all my fucking Hibs mates giving us absolute pelters for it, and then I was like, all right, brilliant. Like, can't even say that. You're getting pumped to home at Raith. I mean, what can you actually say other than we're shite and this is an embarrassment? But then that goes and happens, and it just meant, especially since I've had a few beers as well, I was just not hanging back. Just absolutely tearing into them. It was glorious.
you would think with their history of the team they support that they would maybe think, right, maybe we'll wait to see what happens in the semi-final first, and then once we get through, then we'll bring up the Raith game.
Yeah. Right, let's move on to the second semi. Livingston beaten St Mirren by 1-0, a game that started fairly entertaining, ended fairly entertaining, but it was a bit drab for the kind of 60 minutes in the middle, I think it's fair to say, Tom.
Yeah, not a great game. I mean, it was of the two matches, it was the one I was kind of looking most forward to, and I thought the way that Livingston have been playing in the last couple of months, and St Mirren being pretty dogged and have had some fantastic results in the cup, I thought that this would be the one to watch. It wasn't, partly I think possibly by design, where Livingston got ahead fairly early on and until kind of the last 20 minutes managed to pretty successfully manage the game. But also St Mirren maybe many things, but one up front, Eamon Brophy up front on his own did not work. And the only out ball that they the only time they ever seemed to be of any threat was from set pieces, until the last 20 minutes they brought a beak on, and that kind of changed things. So I think partly it wasn't a great game because, you know, Livy got ahead and they were able to. It was kind of another strength of the ball. I hadn't seen them manage a game like this because they've usually been pretty tenacious. They score and they will look to go and kill games off. In this, they looked a lot more like, right, we have our lead. We're sounding them out. St Mirren didn't offer an awful lot until the latter stages. So I think a lot of the reason that it wasn't a particularly entertaining game was very good game management by Livingston, and their, you know, their supporters are not going to care. It wasn't a particularly exciting game either.
Joe, what was your take of the game? Do you think it was a mistake, first of all, to start Brophy? I know that he started the week before after his signing, but we've kind of talked about it, that Brophy, well, he's played one up front before. It's not the best way to get the best out of him. And with St Mirren kind of having settled in to a kind of way of playing, now, that's not going to last forever, and I think it's perfectly fine to sign Eamon Brophy, give him a 3-year deal, which I think is what they did, and say, right, this is our leading man for the future, but for the meantime, let's kind of go with what's suited us recently. And what's suited them recently is a big guy up front who can hold the ball up and bring others into play, and knocking the ball long to Eamon Brophy for pretty much the entire first half certainly didn't look like a natural fit.
Yeah, so this is something I think I spoke about last week, and I've watching St Mirren last few games, having heard a lot of comments about their turnaround under Goodwin, and individual players being praised to the hilt, that there's a real lack of cutting edge or creativity in the final third, and that was on show throughout the 90 minutes against Livingston. You see, as Tom mentioned, they were most dangerous when they had two up front, and when you've got a midfield that doesn't create a lot of chances for a striker, because Brophy is someone who he'll do a lot of will and work. He will create chances for himself, but it means getting the ball to him a lot for him to try and do that. And when I say create chances for himself, I mean turn it and shoot from ridiculous angles. So Brophy has been at his best when he was at Kilmarnock, when he had players around, even when he played up front in his own, that players around him like Greg Stewart. I don't see a Greg Stewart type player in the St Mirren team. I think Dylan Connolly's got a lot of promise, as has Jay McGrath. Brandon Mason is, by all accounts, a fullback or wingback playing as a winger. So just straight away, I looked at that team and thought, there's not a lot of support there for Eamon Brophy. There's not someone who is going to kind of connect the dots almost between midfield and himself. And it's no surprise that they really struggled to break Livingston down. I think when Livingston seen that starting lineup, John Guthrie and Effie Ambrose would have been absolutely delighted. And they obviously got a bit of more of a test when Obika came on. But when you are as one-dimensional as St Mirren were and are at times, then Livingston are going to have, a team like Livingston are going to have very few problems.
I think one of the things
that's something that's I was wary about with Brophy signing, and St Mirren fans absolutely delighted by it. I think he is a good player, but he needs to have the right players around him. And again, it could be a long term thing with Goodwin building a team, and it's in the early stages. He's reduced the average age of it, so it is there. But at the time of now, I don't think he's the ideal player in a 4-3-3, as you will.
Yeah, I think he's a case of he's a definite upgrade in quality over what is available, but not in the system that Goodwin has been playing. I think last season Jim Goodwin fixed the defence. This season he's largely fixed the midfield, and maybe next season he'll fix them up front. But it hasn't happened yet. And you know, like you say, Brophy has played as a lone striker before, I think largely at Kilmarnock out of necessity, because there wasn't other options available when he was played as a lone striker. But when he was at his best, he had, you know, Greg Stewart or Nicky Kabamba around him, and he got an awful lot more out of them. And you could see when Obika came on, he although he sort of changed the momentum of the game. He wasn't the one. There were, you know, the two chances that they had both fell to Ibaka, and unfortunately, you don't really want them to fall to Ibaka because he isn't a natural finisher, I think, is being kind. But he has suited the way that they've played. He suited the way that he suited that system an awful lot more. And when they were missing the kind of link players, in particular Jake Doyle-Hayes, who has been one of the links between the midfield and attack, I was very surprised that they weren't a little more progressive.
Has Doyle-Hayes been the link? Because when I've watched him, he's been a wee bit deeper, and that's my issue with St Mirren, is the fact that they don't have someone like that in the squad. I mean, McGrath can play as a 10, but I still don't see him as that consistent player who you can kind of hang your hat on as in a 4-2-3-1 or further forward in a 4-3-3.
Probably not consistent, and I admittedly I am basing this on cup matches and the games against Aberdeen, where he's been outstanding in all of those and has been a little more progressive. I'm not consistent, but a big miss for the way that they set up and get back and forward. Like, I think they were missing bodies. They were, and it was a very it was a pretty young central midfield. And Jake Doyle-Hayes wouldn't necessarily provide a huge amount of difference in quality, but the energy and having so, and he does tend to get forward in support at least. Whereas certainly for the first half, the only time there was open play, the only time we even saw Eamon Brophy from open play, there was nobody surrounding him. The only time there was any kind of threat was from a couple of corners and, you know, some set pieces from within their own half, actually, that were kind of launched forward.
It was a strange approach and a stranger team because of it, because Cavan McPherson coming in for Jake Doyle-Hayes, okay, fair enough. It's somebody who could get their foot on the ball, can spray passes around, and you've got a midfield three who can all kind of do that. McGrath can go be that link man. Erehon is maybe not... That isn't as much of a standout quality for him, but it's part of his arsenal. Erehon in the centre of the park is kind of like a Swiss Army knife. He can do a little bit of everything. So you've got the bodies there to try and pass your way around Livingston and keep hold of possession and dominate the ball, try and get Livy to retreat. But instead, they just bypassed the midfield, especially in the first half, just launched it over their heads. And if you're going to do that, and there are other areas as well where he was a little bit, Goodwin was a little bit cautious, like starting Mason over Dermis on the left, then it also, I'm not sure it made much sense to start with McPherson and not, for instance, Ryan Flynn or Sam Foley, somebody with a bit more experience. And if you're going to do that, if you're going to just knock it long and you're maybe going to try and, you know, beat Livingston at quote-unquote their own game in terms of, you know, trying to battle in the midfield area, then, you know, why not go with the guys who are more used to battling rather than some of these kind of younger players who are a bit more technical and a bit more kind of nicer to watch on the ball, but maybe not as effective. And if that's your strategy, I just thought it was a bit weird.
I would be fascinated to know what Goodwin saw in Effie Ambrose and John Guthrie that made him think we'll be able to sit deep and hit this long, because it had to be by design. Like, it could The selection that he put out, fair enough, maybe it didn't fit that, but it was the only thing that they were doing in the first half anyway. It was the only thing that during the only direction they were going. Admittedly, Livingston did sit, you know, they scored and they sat a little deeper, but I don't know what the plan was with this. I don't know what Goodwin's plan to impose anything, any ideas he had on Livingston in this game.
Looking at Livingston, you maybe said this is one of their worst, if not their worst, performance since Martindale became full-time manager, and yet they've won a cup final to get into they've won a cup semi-final to get to a final against St Johnstone, which I think a lot of people will fancy them to win, and that I think says a lot about the immediate turnaround at Livy. And I wonder as well whether, having got the early goal, having given themselves something to potentially lose, I wonder whether nerves kind of kicked in at all, because I don't think they were quite as I don't think they would have been quite as deep at points in the second half if it was just a bog standard league game. I think they would have maybe went out a wee bit more to try and kill the game off. But at the end of the day, they got the result they needed. And a lot of that, Joel, was to do with Scott Robinson. When you were watching Scott Robinson playing in a midfield two for Gary Locke's Hearts alongside Jamie Hamill, were you thinking, yes, this is going to be a man of the match in a cup semi-final one day, scoring the goal while being a central striker?
No, and it's even more so because we actually saw him as a central striker when he first came into the Hearts team, as Laszlo kind of tried to make something off him in that position. I think you wrote somewhere, I think maybe it was in the document for the TV show, was the fact that as soon as he dropped out into playing for East Fife, and I think it was on amateur terms when he did so, that as soon as that happened, that you're kind of, there was almost like an understanding or an acceptance. Okay, that's where he is. He's one of those players who broke through top flight club, well, and then kind of just drops, and to find himself back where he is incredible. I do remember speaking to mates, and someone laughed about having Scott Robinson up front. It was like he's head and shoulders above most fucking Hearts team at the moment.
Oh,
and
but he'd undoubtedly be shite if we got him back.
No, yeah, absolutely. every single one of those Livingston players put him in the Hearts team, and they just turn to dust. But no, Robinson, he probably epitomises it for this game and under Martindale, but I think this game as a whole shows it's more than intangibles of Livingston, just their mentality and their character, their attitude to see out, to dig in, and I think that's been restored. I think that's been restored under Martindale, and no one better than Robinson. And you look at just how a big thing for me when watching Livingston is how they're so intelligent. They get a lot of it's about how they make it difficult for teams to beat. They're really hard working, but they're actually a really intelligent team as well, and they read the game so well. Because you look at Robinson and just how they react to situations, and how he reacted, how Effie Ambrose reacted to the flick on, and Robinson reacted to the header, and that's a big thing. Because with Robinson up front, they need someone who is switched on, because he is kind of similar like Brophy. Is if you're playing long balls to him, he's not going to, you don't expect him to bully defenders, so he has to be smart, and he has been. He has to know when to bump into defenders, know when to kind of run in behind him. He is, obviously he's the one player in that team who has probably, like, he's the kind of the face of the Martindale revolution on the pitch.
It's a bit like, if you've seen the film Ratatouille, the Pixar film Ratatouille, Martindale is like Remy the Rat, and Holt was Linguini, and now Remy the Rat is in charge of the restaurant, and he doesn't have to have a conduit between him and his art. That's tenuous. No,
I liked it, Tom. I liked it.
absolutely, Scott Robinson. I mean, his fifth goal in 9 games. Previously, he had 3 in 42. And I mean, I think there are 4 or 5 players in the Livingston team, you know, that you could argue that the entire squad has been rejuvenated under Martindale. But I think there are 4 or 5 who, even at the start of the season, you wouldn't have been surprised if you fast forwarded a year and they found themselves in the Championship or League One. And now they are, you know, potentially going to finish the season with a cup winner's medal, could easily qualify for Europe. Incredibly tenacious performance from Scott Robinson. And I think there were times, and yes, I would say almost undoubtedly all round the worst performance I'd seen from Livingston since Martindale came in. And I mean that as a compliment, but there's almost something like they're playing a slightly different sport to everybody else. Like, they're playing rugby league or something, because they win second ball so often. It seems like if you take possession, get forward, and there will be someone to offload onto. You know, there's always an option, and it's not an option for a pass. It's like there's always somebody else that's going to win either the second ball when you're tackled, or if you run into, you know, you run into a blind alley, there's somebody following up. And they didn't get an opportunity to do it quite as often as they have recently, but there were spells, especially in the second half when they were breaking, that you could still see them doing that.
Yeah, that's, sorry, I was interrupting Tom there because I was just about to say in the second half, the one that kind of epitomised what you're exactly what you're talking about is when they broke, and I think it was ended up with Nicky Devlin having the chance. It just seemed it was. I've never thought of that analogy before, but it was. I think it was a very good one about rugby league. Is that someone gets tackled, and then there's someone following up. Like Sybil gets tackled, and Pittman's following up to collect the ball. He gets tackled, then Holt picks up the ball, and then he gets tackled. Robinson fires it across, and then Mullins there. He gets tackled. Devlin's. I think it's a really good analogy, and again, it comes down to the fact that just there. Just how well this Livingston team read the game, and it's almost like can you remember playing Championship Manager or Football Manager? One of the training sessions was shadow play. That's what I can imagine Livingston doing under Martindale. It sounds really boring, but just him kind of drilling everyone and just like but like almost just throwing a ball into the middle of the pitch, loose ball, and everyone kind of just scrambles and knows where their position is. They didn't play well, but at no point during that 90 minutes did I think, oh, St Mirren are going to get a goal here, or St Mirren are going to win this.
Okay, we'll leave the Beck Red Cup games for now. Well, forever. I don't doubt we're going to talk about them again in the future. That's a terrible segue, Fowler. We're going to leave the Beck Red Cup games and we're going to talk about the two Scottish Premiership games, but we've kind of run quite long, so let's just only discuss these for about 10 minutes. So instead of just going right through the matches piece by piece, well, instead, I'll go to each and just ask for your kind of main takeaways from each game. So we'll start with you, Tom, and we shall begin. Let's go to Pittodrie. Aberdeen 2, Motherwell 0. What was your main takeaway for this one?
I think one from each team. I think there's been a bit of a debate around whether the Aberdeen formation has worked as well as it had either in earlier in the season. I think this was one match where you really, you know, the 3-4-3 or 3-4-2-1, whatever it is, really worked well with the sort of double wing back attack.
Hang on though. Was it a 3-4-3?
This confused me. To begin with, I thought it was 3-4-2-1 because that's how Wyskip had it. And then the more I watched it, I was thinking this is a bit more like a 4-2-3-1.
I was certain it was a back four. Hoban was far too wide on the right to be a.
Hoban went far right. I thought at the time it was a back three, but Hoban, as soon as Liam Polworth got sent off, Hoban was basically playing wing back with. Ryan Hedges. Kennedy was further forward than he has been for in recent games, and all of the back three technically scored, although Ash Taylor's was off. I'm pretty confident it was a back three, and
I am the opposite because I watched the opening like 10 minutes.
I watched the whole 90, and I was fairly sure. I may be entirely wrong because the game did open up an awful lot when Liam Polworth got sent off, and Hoban was playing at right back, but certainly Ryan Hedges was playing in a right wing back position and was then getting forward. So my ultimate point was Ryan Hedges playing wide. Got an awful lot more joy than Kennedy playing wide. In recent weeks, Kennedy's been largely played as a wing back, which is fine for work rate purposes, but his final ball's not been great. He was pushed a bit further forward. His final ball improved an awful lot more, and he was just a constant nuisance. Hedges playing wide meant that he was constantly moving. Like he was receiving the ball out wide, playing a pass and then finding himself on the edge of the box. Whatever the system, and I'm still fairly sure it was a back three, but whatever the system was, it worked. And it caused Motherwell an awful lot of problems. Had it not been for Liam Kelly, then it could easily have been 4 or 5-0. On Motherwell's point, they seemed to have made so much progress against Rangers last week, especially in defending balls into the box. Here they kind of went back to the side that is quite rightly at the bottom of the league, and every time there was a dead ball, every time there was a corner, every time there was a cross coming into the box, and they looked like they were going to concede. They did concede two.
It was because in the second half, all they did was Aberdeen must had, I don't know, 6-7 corners. Every single corner, they allowed Aberdeen to just do it was 2v1. It was Kennedy and Hedges.
Yeah.
And they would just do 2v1, player around the player, and then just run into the box and then be able to cross it. So that's where the second goal came from. Because they just allowed Aberdeen to work it around them. I seen it first and I thought, okay, I think it was just after the signing off, so they probably just a mix up. They won't allow that to happen again, and then it happened again and again and again. It was almost like they were willing Aberdeen to come into the box, but then that's fine. But you got to defend it, which they ended up didn't. It was just I just couldn't believe what I was watching.
Yeah, the especially the second one, where not only do they switch off from the corner, you know, it's kind of amateur level that if there's two men taking the corner, you might want to watch the second one. Let Hedges run in on goal. Nobody deals with a ball across the box, and then like Jake Carroll's at the back, like, oh yeah.
And but they got a warning because of
Ash Taylor's 6-yard box.
They got a warning because Ash Taylor his disallowed goal came from a 2v1. And then they just kept on allowing Aberdeen to do it. I don't know if either it was a really bad plan from Motherwell, or it was just it reeked off incompetence that no one on the pitch or the sidelines kind of switched on and thought we can't allow them to do that, because generally it was the most obvious thing for footballers to do. If they've got two people at a corner, then you move two people out there to stop them taking it short and running at the box, which Aberdeen did time and time again.
My main takeaway for this one was Sherwin Seedorf. Oh Jesus, is he rubbish! it's kind of mental that Graham Alexander, he started to bring. Well, did Kelly arrive at the club? He pretty much arrived right away. I think they pretty much had that lined up anyway. And so he's obviously been an upgrade, and they did need to sign a goalkeeper, to be fair. But they've now gone out and signed another striker. It's a big striker, and he came on, and I've blanked on his name. Harry Smith. That's it. And he certainly looked like he was a big boy, and unlike guys who usually come up to Scottish football and are big, he actually has a decent jump on him as well and could win the ball in the air. So that'll be interesting to see if that kind of changes Motherwell's kind of style of play going forward. But I still can't believe they've not gone out inside a winger yet, because they don't have any that are any good. And starting with Sherwin Seedorf in this game kind of proved that. He was rubbish. Absolutely rubbish. And it continues to be a big problem for Motherwell. And also Liam Polworth said it off was very funny.
Not only was it very funny, but getting sent off for a foul and abusive language, and if you watch the highlights, being able to hear someone on the sidelines go, oh, fuck off, ref, like resonating around the entire empty stadium is very funny.
And it was also the bizarre aspect of him getting sent off, but him having to hobble down, like, well, kind of walk down with his arm in a sling. Because the way he fell, it was quite amusing. So yeah, I made notes about the formation and the corners. The first goal, obviously Hoban scores it, but Hoban did really well before it was got taken. Sam Cosgrove, who for me was a wee bit off it, it looked like sometimes when he runs, it looks like, I think they do like a drill they do in the NFL, is when, you know, when like someone's having to sprint and they've got rope around them and someone else is holding them back.
Oh yeah, like a training thing, yeah.
Yeah, that is Sam Cosgrove, and it just seemed like he was not switched on as with the creative players around him. Sorry, there's a phone going off in the background. But it was Hoban. So Cosgrove for the first goal switched off, and Hoban had to tell him to get into the right position, and then that when he did, it meant that Gallagher had two players to mark, had Hoban to mark and Cosgrove to mark, and he ended up not marking either, and it opened up for Hoban to score. Set pieces this weekend were terrible, absolutely terrible defensively.
Right, let's move on to the game at Ibrox, where I'm sure you're going to bring this up yet again, because Rangers scored twice from set pieces in a 5-0 victory over Ross County. My kind of main takeaway for this one, I mean, it was a walk in the park for Rangers, as we kind of expected it was going to be. You're playing one of the worst teams in the league at home, you've not been particularly that great yourselves, but they've started to show a bit more life recently, and you were kind of thinking, somebody's going to get smashed here. It happened to be Ross County, but I still didn't really agree with John Hughes setting up in a 3-5-2 system, because you're kind of conceding the wings to the team that crossed the ball most in the league. And that's pretty much what happened at the opening goal. Tavernier had too much space to get the cross in. Morelos nods it, not down, but nods it across, and Kent comes in, a good header. Kind of one of those tricky headers that usually you see players missing quite a lot, because it's hard to it's hard to get over the ball, but he'd done very well to just kind of put the right amount of power on it, so it just kind of looped into the back of the net. But yeah, I don't get playing 3-5-2 against Rangers.
I think you're being generous. I think it was more kind of 5-3-2.
You know what I mean? Like conceding the wings to Rangers is never a good idea.
That first goal was the first two goals, and then obviously the penalty as well. So bad defensively, but. Second one, the penalty was, it was quite good pressing from Rangers, but without trying to sound like Alex McLeish after Kazakhstan, the Kazakhstan defeat for Scotland, I was like, oh, County look okay in these first 4 minutes, and then they conceded that goal, which was Callum Morris. I don't know why he's getting dragged to Iacoviti with Morelos, and then that leaves a massive gap when you're playing five at the back with Kent to score.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't, like, you can, to some extent, you can write off Ross County going to Ibrox and, you know, getting smashed. There's no real shame in that, especially where they are. But John Hughes, it was naive. And to say that we, you know, we set up to be hard to beat. Like, if you want to even start considering how to stop Rangers, stop Tavernier shelling balls from 40, 50 yards. And he did that all day. Like, all the space that he wanted. And especially if you were going to set up with a system that presumably is to make things congested in the middle of the park and to give them less time on the ball. But basically Ross County set up letting Tavernier have a lot of space and with a very, very high line. And yes, for the first 4 minutes, they looked fairly, you're like, oh, they're in this, you know, they're putting themselves about. But if you let Tavernier float crosses in from the halfway line, sooner or later you're gonna get problems. And so Rangers score from that. Shortly after that, Callum Morris, very high line, trying to take the ball out of defence. When there's two men bearing down on him, they get a bit lucky. Iacoviti wins the ball back from Kent, then takes three heavy touches and gives away and has to chase back and give away a penalty. So I think, while they're, you know, in isolation, fine, at the end of the season, Ross County's position in the league is not going to be particularly determined by whether they got smashed by Rangers 5-0. I don't think Rangers really needed to get out of first gear. I don't really understand how John Hughes can say, you know, the man who would have delivered 10 in a row, John Hughes, that we set up to be hard to beat when they played such a high line, when they played into Rangers' hands with so many tactical decisions, even in the selection, dropping players, you know, Ross County, the selection. Jermaine Hilton's had a very good few weeks. He was really good in the Aberdeen game a couple of weeks ago, and quite a bold move to take on Leo Hjelde, who's only 17, and throw him straight into the starting lineup. So yes, can't really complain too much if you get beaten, but I do think Ross County played into their hands.
I had one hard else what to say. Well, obviously Rangers scored a couple of absolutely brilliant goals. So you had the Rebo strike and the 373 pass move, which ended with Ryan Jack scoring. But the big one, like the real big one that for me that stood out was, like, we had my JR, the WWE commentator moment, when there was this ball guy running around in the midfield. I was like, who's that? I was like, by God, it's Ross Draper. He looks scary enough. Now he's got a skinhead. He looks fucking terrifying.
And on that note, I think that'll do us for Monday's podcast. Thank you very much to Joe and to Tom. Thank you to everybody for listening. If you'd like to hear us talk about how shite Hearts are and whether there's a title race in the Scottish Championship this year, then you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/terracepodcast, where as little as £2 per month, you can get a lot of extra content. You can obviously get the £5 a month, which will unlock everything, and £7 a month, which gets you a couple of goodies as well at the end of the season. So yes, once again, that is patreon.com/terracepodcast. And until the next show, I'm Craig Fowler. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.